This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
A fairly benign presence on the landscape in regards to human safety, at least. So it's just interesting how those cultural stories perpetuate themselves over time.
Well, on the other side of the spectrum, I've just finished reading E. McAllister's book, Following the Last Wild Wolves, and he writes about, actually, I was inspired to read that book by reading your section about the rainforest wolves.
Yeah.
And I just had the book lying around for 2 years. I was supposed to do an interview with Ian, and it never happened, but now it's going to happen because of my fascination with wolves has been really rekindled. But in reading that book, it was one of the things that really gripped me was he's describing these wolf packs that den in what basically are the foundations of old Indian villages. And he thinks that that shows that there used to be a much closer symbiotic relationship between wolves and people, particularly on the west, on the Pacific coast of North America, than it's probably possible for us from Euro-American backgrounds to be able to fathom.
Yeah, you know, I think that's definitely true. From a biological perspective, actually, humans and wolves fill a similar niche. We're both large, adaptable carnivores on the landscape, and we share many resources, and we share, you know, preferences for habitat as well. So, and this is true in the interior of the Pacific Northwest. It's true on the coast. You know, on the coast, wolves focus on feeding on salmon in many places, and of course, humans as well. You know, humans didn't evolve as fishermen. You know, we evolved, you know, probably scavenging large carcasses out in the you know, savannas in Africa, and wolves similarly evolved, you know, to consume large ungulates and things like that. But you put both wolves and humans in a landscape where there's lots of fish, and we figure out how to access that resource. And because of that, all of a sudden we have a shared habitat again, in the same way that in the interior where humans focus on livestock ranching or hunting ungulates, you know, wolves have the same resources, and so we're gonna share habitat and interests, and that in and of itself creates the opportunity for conflict. And this is something that's very predictable from a biological perspective. If you have two species that have shared resource needs, that there can be conflict there, and you'll see that with wolves' relationships to other large carnivores in the landscape, and in places where wolves share the landscape with even bigger carnivores, like if you go to the eastern Russia and Siberia, where there's Amur tigers there, and places where Amur tiger populations go up, wolf populations may go down because the Amur tigers are trying to exclude them from their shared resources. And so it's not surprising that wolves will do that with coyotes. Where wolf populations go up, coyote populations tend to shift and often decrease because wolves are trying to exclude coyotes. And so we'll see that same pattern with humans as well. In many places where human populations go up, we tend to try to reduce the number of wolves.
So maybe in order to reduce the coyote population here in Portland, we should perhaps introduce wolves into the Portland area.
Except well, you know, Portland, historically, northwestern Oregon probably didn't used to have coyotes. Coyotes have recently come into the west coast of Washington State and probably northwestern Oregon as well in the once wolves were removed, and then with clear cutting and introduction of agriculture. So coyotes that's actually a perfect example of some of those shifts that happen when you shift the population of an apex carnivore. Some of the smaller animals might shift their populations as well.
Well, it seems to me that...
I think it's also worth noting, though, just going back to the Northwest Coast, that despite the fact that people and wolves share a resource there, the traditional culture there was not one of feeling like there was a sense of competition between wolves and humans. And actually many First Nations along the Northwest Coast had a very reverential perspective and have to this day a very reverential perspective on wolves. And wolves are an integral part of their sense of place. And
Well, before we get into the role that wolves play in really protecting healthy ecosystems, I just want to talk a bit more about coyotes, because it seems to me that people actually confuse some of the habits of wolves and coyotes and blame wolves for things that coyotes are actually doing. So I wonder if we could just make a distinction between the two breeds, actually, two species, and then talk about why maybe coyotes have a different kind of behavior, which is more of a nuisance to people, actually, than wolves.
I think that would be pretty hard to say. The thing about wolves and coyotes, and domestic dogs for that matter, is they're very adaptable. And there can be a fair bit of overlap in their behavior. And they all, you know, wolves and coyotes both have, you know, a niche in ecosystems that, you know, that they serve out. So coyotes typically focus on hunting small mammals and rodents and things like that. And obviously for humans, we see things like rats and mice often can be a source of great displeasure for us. And mesocarnivores or medium and small-sized carnivores like a coyote tend to put a lot of pressure on those species. Whereas wolves tend to focus on larger animals that they hunt, you know, deer and elk. So they fit a slightly different niche there. Coyotes have shown themselves to be a lot more adaptable in terms of living in closer proximity to humans, so such as in the city of Portland, perhaps. But as far as saying, you know, it really depends on the person and the culture and the specific place of whether or not coyotes might be more of a nuisance for humans, or whether wolves might pose more problems, or whether the ecological services that either of those species provide might be something that is perceived as more valuable for us. So it's a kind of a complex dynamic there between those two species and the ecosystem they live in, and then humans living in that ecosystem as well.
Well, let's back up a little bit and talk about the role that wolves play as what's called the apex carnivore in basically what kind of ecosystems they shape and what happens when wolves are removed from those ecosystems.
Yeah, so again, very varied, because wolves occupy so many different habitats. Their role in each of these different ecosystems they live in can vary. But typically, one of the important roles that apex carnivores or large carnivores play in an ecosystem is in interactions with their prey species. So that would be deer and elk typically. And in the northwestern United States, wolves, in conjunction with mountain lions and bears, can influence the population dynamics of elk and deer. And in places where elk populations become extremely high in the absence of predation, that can deteriorate other parts of the ecosystem. So specifically plants that they focus on consuming and parts of the landscape where they would tend to favor to hang out, they'll have a much higher impact in those places in the absence of predation pressure. And with the with an increase in predation pressure, either through the reestablishment of wolf populations or increasing populations of other large carnivores, some of those negative impacts on habitats and plant species that those herbivores focus on, you know, can greatly diminish. And then there's a trickle down, basically, effect there in terms of the other animals that depend on that sensitive habitat, often riparian zones, things like that.
Well, we're talking this morning with David Moskowitz, who is a wildlife tracker, photographer, outdoor educator, and organizer of citizen wildlife tracking and monitoring groups. And he has a book out called Wolves in the Land of Salmon, which is actually full of amazing photographs as well as great narrative about what it's like to be out in the wilds of the Pacific Northwest, finding where the wolves live and following them and watching how they live. So we're going to learn a little bit more about that today. I wanted to talk about, let's go back and look at the time when wolves were first being reintroduced to Idaho and what some of the conflicts that were arose amongst particularly the ranching community versus the environmental community and the wildlife advocates who were promoting the wolf reintroduction. So let's talk about what were the dynamics for that. Why did people decide it was time to get wolves to return to Wyoming and Idaho and Montana?
Yeah, well, wolves are one of the first species listed under the Federal Endangered Species Act when it was created back in the 1970s. And so there's been a longstanding interest in protecting this species in, you know, very modern history. And research basically showed that the habitat was good for reintroduction of the species in central Idaho and in the Yellowstone area. And so there's a great deal of movement, both because it's a charismatic species and because there was a duty to act basically through the Endangered Species Act to reintroduce that species. As probably most folks know, the relationship between people that live in much of the Western United States and the federal government is a complex one. And so the reintroduction of wolves in central Idaho was an act carried out by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and much to the chagrin and opposition of many people that lived in those local areas. And this is carrying on a kind of an ongoing conflict between people in their debate over the role of the federal government in people's lives. And this is one of the things that's pretty hard to sort out when you're trying to talk about wolves and the role of wolves and the impact of wolves, is that there's another issue going on here, which is the role of government in people's lives. And you can't really resolve issues around wolves and people's perspective about wolves if actually one of the issues is the role of the federal government. You know, I mean, you can't, there's no biological research that's going to help you. There are no research projects to look at the impacts of wolf populations on elk numbers or wolf populations on livestock when, you know, whether or not you could resolve those conflicts, there's still an underlying conflict about how people perceive, you know, the role of government in their lives. You kind of need to address that one separately to some degree.
Well, one of the great divides seems to be that, or at least this is the perception in the rural and frontier Pacific Northwest, is that the people who want to encourage the reintroduction and expansion of wolf packs in the Pacific Northwest live in the cities, and the people who really are being impacted by it, the ranchers and other people who live along the frontier, they are they're the ones who are opposed to it, and they're the ones who know best because they actually have to deal with it. And those city people, it's just a romance for them. So how does that argument play out, and how can it be countered?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I think there's a reasonable statement there. I personally, greatly appreciate and value the fact that we have, as a society, a value of having people that live and work on the landscape. And I think that's a really important part of our tradition. And I certainly hope it will continue. And it's undoubtedly true that in some instances, the reestablishment of wolves will make it harder for, you know, people that are, you know, have been ranching or running hunting outfits without wolves, might make that more challenging. So I think it's worth recognizing that there's truth there, and that on the flip side of it, as a society, we have decided that we value both that, you know, our freedom to hunt and our ability to make a living off, you know, the land. We also have valued wildlife and the presence of wildlife on the landscape. And our natural heritage belongs to all of us, whether or not we live in a city or, you know, we live in a rural landscape. And so this process of having a conversation as a society about how to find a balance that allows for all of our values to be reflected, for people to continue to carry out, you know, their traditional livelihood activities, and to maintain the, you know, wealth of natural heritage that we have is an important one, and it's a complex one, and there's no right answers to it, and there's no simple solutions. And I think in order for us to continue to, you know, be a vibrant democracy, we're going to keep having to have this conversation and deal with conflicts in, you know, in a reasonable manner, and recognize that there's values and needs that many different constituents have. And one thing that I really, as I was writing the book, that I started looking at in the literature, when I was reading a lot of the literature from groups that were very adamantly for the reestablishment of wolf populations, they talk about health, ecosystem health, and how this was supporting the health of the landscape. And when I was reading literature for, you know, specifically like hunting groups talking about how wolf populations were destroying the health of elk populations, and how this was threatening potentially, you know, humans' ability to continue having hunting opportunities. And I realized that we all want the same thing. We want health for ourselves. We want the continued health of the landscapes that support us. And you know, if you live in an urban area, the ecosystem services that a large block of wildlands provides for you might be things like clean air and clean water, and just the inherent presence of biodiversity is something that many humans value, and is a service that may provide for us in the future in ways we don't understand. So these are important things for us to feel safe and well in the world. And at the same time, if you make your livelihood by guiding elk hunting trips or by running livestock, then wolves in the same way might be, in a more direct, immediate way, threatening what you perceive to be the health and well-being of yourself, your family, your community. And the reality of it is, we can have wolves on the landscape and still have opportunities for people to make a living off the land. But it's just a matter of how we find that balance and make sure that all of these different groups' needs are being tended to.
Well, when the wolves were first starting to disperse around Idaho, there was a great deal of concern in Oregon, and I would hear people from Eastern Oregon saying, the wolves are not going to come to Oregon. No way will the wolves be reestablished in Oregon. I didn't understand until much later that the reason why the opposition in Oregon was so intense, even more so in some ways in Idaho or Washington, was that there's a larger percentage of the landscape in Eastern Oregon is dedicated to ranching. And that is actually in some ways more developed in terms of human terms than a lot of the Idaho and Washington mountain areas. I wonder if that played into, or how that played into, the incredible resistance in Oregon to allow the wolves that were naturally dispersing from Idaho to actually find homes here in Oregon.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably true. There's a long-standing interest in supporting the livestock industry, and the hunting industry is very important in northeastern Oregon. And there's a really mixed, patchwork of public and private lands and use of public lands for grazing. And so, kind of makes sense. Interestingly, historically, elk almost disappeared completely from the Wallawas, Blue Mountains, and were eventually reestablished through reintroductions and a moratorium on hunting. And the livestock industry started complaining about that because they felt like the elk were going to be competing with the forage for their livestock. And now those two interest groups are much more closely aligned in dealing with, things like wolves and their concerns about that. But I think it also points out that that over time, perspectives change on things. And, elk have become a very iconic part of the landscape in northeastern Oregon again, and a very important part of that landscape in terms of the economy and hunting, and it's very likely that as people adapt to the presence of wolves on the landscape, over time, an appreciation for the things that they will be providing to those communities, as well as an appreciation for what the actual impacts of what they'll be and how to manage that, I think will be forthcoming, and perhaps we'll look back and 80 or 90 years and just be able to look at the reestablishment of wolves from kind of the same perspective that we can think about the disappearance and reappearance of elk on that same landscape.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the dispersal of wolves, because what do we start out with when wolves are first introduced or introduced back into Idaho? How many wolves were there, and how long did it take before they started leaving, crossing state boundaries and swimming the Snake River?
Yeah, so, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but I think it was 2 years of reintroductions of, I want to say, about 30 animals.
And where did the animals come from that they were introducing?
They were translocated from further north in the Rocky Mountains in British Columbia and Alberta, and that was the closest genetically similar population that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service could get access to for reestablishing wolves. So, that's, as a side note, there's a lot of stories about how these are different wolves than the wolves that used to be there. And there's no real historical truth to that. The wolves further north are the same species that were there previously. So, but that is something you'll hear about in the media, and that's probably where it comes from, because they were moved from further north in the landscape south. But wolves, you know, are engineered to travel, and they travel a lot for hunting. You know, it's very reasonable for them to run 20 miles in an evening just on their hunting forays. And when a young adult animal is ready to leave home because its parents aren't providing food for it anymore, it will do something called disperse. And dispersal can be a short distance. In some places, they might just move next door into an adjacent piece of habitat. But very often, young wolves will travel hundreds of miles. And it doesn't really matter whether or not adjacent habitat is available or not. There's some wolves that will just travel long distances. And wolves, even in a very small population, might start sending offspring to very distant areas. And actually, the story of OR7 is a great example of that. You know, the wolf that traveled all the way down to Northern California and is still running around creating headlines. He came from the Naha pack, the first pack in northeastern Oregon, and there's lots of habitat between him and where he ended up in northeastern California and southern Oregon. But it just had this biological imperative to travel.
I was just reading about him again this morning, and I found an article that was from just about 2 months ago, and that he had crossed back into Oregon. I guess he didn't find what he was looking for in California. And the thought is that, I mean, he's looking for a mate, but it seems odd to be looking for a mate in places where there haven't been wolves for, what, like the last 70 years.
Yeah, so this is, again, it's one of those biological drives to disperse, and we don't, as a humans, don't understand how all that works in animals, but many large carnivores do have that imperative, and young males typically will disperse further than females, which is actually something that you can see in modern humans as well. A lot of young men end up much further from home than young women do, so he may very well live out his life without running into another wolf out there, or he could turn around and travel almost all the way back to the Naha pack. That would not be unheard of in the history of, you know, our documentation of dispersal of wolves. I think, you know, OR7 also there's a great story there as well in terms of looking at all of the landscapes that he traveled through and has traveled through and probably will travel through, and to realize that one of the things about wolves is that because they cover such large distances, it requires us as humans to think really big about how we manage landscapes and to recognize that there's no islands, there's no ecological islands, you know, everything's connected, and that the presence of wolves on the landscape affects not just people in very remote, distant, wild places, but, you know, this animal is crossing highways and skirting communities all over the state, literally. So as a side note, actually, one of my next project is joining three other folks to follow the dispersal trail of OR7 to try to kind of see some of the landscapes that he was traveling through and just raise awareness about wolves on the landscape in Oregon and Northern California and the Pacific Northwest in general.
Well, do you know what his route was? He was tracked by a radio caller, so I'm kind of curious how much...
Public information, you know, on that, not the specific route that he followed, but the general route, you know, because wolves will sometimes, you know, retrace their steps. That information's, you know, important to protect by Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. But they, you know, for public information, they shared the general route. And we're going to try to follow that route, see where the wolf went, and interact with folks along the way.
Well, we're talking this morning with David Moskowitz, who, as you can hear, is quite a wildlife tracker. And he said you're about off to track the famous OR7, or Journey, as he's known to his friends. And we're talking, he recently wrote a book called Wolves in the Land of Salmon, and we're talking this morning about some of his adventures in tracking the wolves. when you wrote the book, you described two wolf packs in Oregon. But when I was doing some checking this morning, I've found articles that relate to at least six wolf packs. Do you know about any more dispersals that have happened in recent years?
It's from northeastern Oregon.
Well, I'm assuming that the wolf packs in the rest of Oregon are coming from the northeast, from the Imnaha, the original pack. But I'm also wondering how far west they've come, if you have any idea.
Yeah, so, you know, because OR7 was radio collared, we got this really great picture of the landscape that he traveled on. But it's very likely that many other wolves have dispersed in a variety of other directions. You know, there's been documented wolves that have dispersed back into Idaho. There's wolf packs that wolves that are going back and forth across the Oregon Washington border. It's likely that wolves have moved further west at some one point or another. And as I said, wolf populations can be very dynamic. So I don't know that they've definitively documented other wolves moving west to the Cascades, but it certainly could have happened. And some of those wolves could have come back, and there may very well be a few animals rolling around out there still.
I mean, I'm wondering how long it would be before we might encounter wolves on Mount Hood. And what would be the challenges for them to get there?
Yeah, you know, I mean, obviously if OR7 can make it all the way down to Northern California, you know, making it out to Mount Hood is certainly plausible. The research, you know, tends to suggest that actually the best habitat in southern Pacific Northwest and in Oregon is probably the Modoc Plateau and southern Oregon, you know, that Northern California, Southern Oregon area, the southern end of the Cascades there, because there's, you know, high game populations and low human populations. So while the folks around Portland might be super excited to have wolves, on the Mount Hood National Forest, probably wolves like OR7 might see, you know, greener pastures for them a little further south in the state just because of the things they eat. And then again, trying to avoid conflicts with humans.
Well, you write about a lot of different rather disturbed habitats that wolves have reestablished themselves in. There's some of the packs in Washington, particularly in the Cascades in Washington, are not the kinds of environments that one would associate with the wildness of wolves. And I want to compare that with the other wolf population, the truly wild population that you spent a little bit of time tracking on the north coast of British Columbia. What did you see? What surprised you when you were tracking the wolves in some of the packs in Washington state? And I would think in Oregon that they are having to roam through even more disturbed landscapes than some of the ones in Washington.
Yeah, so that's the thing about wolves is that we've painted them as a creature that's like a symbol of wilderness and all that, but actually their habitat preferences are very similar to ours in the sense of, especially in the interior of the continent, where, you know, a lot of our habitat choices are linked to the mildest winter possibilities and then increasing ungulate populations. And so wolves adapt to that. So in places where logging activity increases moose populations, wolf populations might similarly follow suit. And so it's really varied and really, you know, wolf behavior, population dynamics really, really varies depending on the very specific nature of the local ecosystem. And the one crux there is that more human intervention in the landscape, which causes more human presence, tends to be a net negative for wolves. But the things that wolves find to be attractive are not necessarily the large tracts of high elevation wilderness that we have set aside, in the highest peaks of our mountains around the West. That's not necessarily what they're looking for ecologically.
Well, I've been... Continue. Sorry.
Go ahead. Yeah. Well, just conversely, on the central coast of British Columbia, down to sea level, where there's still large tracts of unroaded coastal landscapes, low elevation habitat. This is great habitat for wolves, and as it was probably further south in the region as well, in Oregon and in Washington, at one point.
Let's talk a bit more about these rainforest wolves, because I found them to be quite amazing, being that they are, well, I thought actually reading your book a little bit further away from some of the dangers that other wolf packs experience, but reading the epilogue to McAllister's book, I'm realizing that there's a lot of trophy hunting that goes on in British Columbia. But first, let's talk about just what happens, what you observe when you see wolves that are living under so much less pressure than the wolves that are trying to reestablish themselves inland in the Northwest.
Wolves on the British Columbia coast they're beautiful. It's an amazing spot to watch them interact with the landscape, and because they use a coastal habitat and that like tidal interface, you know, that allows them to be a little bit more visible than when they're spending time in the dense rainforests. And I think the amount of pressure they get there is less, in part because there's less people, in part because the local culture there is far more tolerant and actually protective of wolves traditionally. At the same time, they are facing threats that are similar to elsewhere. You know, there's logging operations that are going on there that affect habitat tremendously. There are trophy hunting, you know, there's trophy hunting that goes on there, although there's been, you know, some great efforts by Rain Coast Conservation Foundation and others, Ian McAllister's group to stem the tide of that, but still big threats up there as well. In places where wolves are less persecuted by people, they tend to be a little less shy. Yellowstone's actually the best example of that, where, you know, wolves inside the park there are protected, and actually, you know, it's like many people spend a lot of time trying to watch them, and wolves there, you know, can be far more tolerant of the presence of humans, as opposed to if you go to the Selkirks or the Blue Mountains in Selkirks in Washington or the Blue Mountains in northeastern Oregon. Wolves are very skittish there because they're being persecuted by humans often, or threatened by them.
Let's talk a little bit about the challenges for wolf survival, because another thing that I learned relatively recently, that wolves in the wild generally live only to be 3 or 4 years old, though the rainforest wolves, I guess they have gray muzzles and live to be 10 or 12 or older. So what are the two things that can shorten a wild wolf's life most notably?
Yeah, well, the biggest predator of wolves in the Northwest is humans, by far, and humans kill many wolves either intentionally, legally or illegally, or accidentally through like roadkill and things like that. The second biggest, second most likely way for a wolf to die at the hands of another animal is from other wolves. Wolves can be very territorial, and so you can have skirmishes that end in death between neighboring packs, or if a dispersing animal shows up in a territory that's occupied. Beyond that, then you can have disease and malnourishment and so forth. But typically humans are the biggest source of mortality for wolves.
But I also understand that when they're going after big prey, particularly moose and elk, I mean, that there's some occupational hazards in that line of work as well.
Yes, so that is certainly another possibility, especially wolves that hunt moose can, you know, get killed by their prey, and they work pretty hard to avoid that, obviously, and so they'll typically, you know, if they can go for juvenile moose in those instances, they'll do that, that's a little bit safer, and wolves are just like us. We're looking to get, you know, get a good meal in a safe way and without too much energy expenditure, but there are some occupational hazards, as it were, of trying to kill large animals with your mouth.
Well, in the last moments that we have here, I want to talk a little bit about your efforts to engage citizens in the kinds of conservation work you do. And I want to talk about the group that you start, Cascade Citizens Wildlife Monitoring Project. What is that, and what is your motivation for training people to learn how to do wildlife tracking?
Great. Yeah, so the Cascade Citizen Wildlife Monitoring Project is a joint effort of Conservation Northwest and Wilderness Awareness School. And the goals of that are to document wildlife along the interstate corridor in Washington State through the Cascades on I-90, as there's road construction going on there, trying to create more permeability or more ability for wildlife to cross the highway there. And then also to document wolves, wolverines, and other rare species around the Cascades and elsewhere in the Northwest, so that we have a better understanding of where these animals are and can best put our conservation and efforts, you know, money and attention in the right way, and then to advocate for the best management that we can for wildlife populations in the state. And for me, I'm very much for citizens being actively engaged in learning about what's going on in the natural world, and so that they can make educated decisions about what they think we as a society should be doing with it. So wildlife tracking, wildlife monitoring potential is just a great way for people to get involved, get out in the field, and actually get a hands-on experience of what's going on there. Not so that they can do what I think is right, but so that they can learn about what they think is right to do. And so having people actively engaged and making direct observations of the natural world is, for me, a vital part of having successful democracy in terms of managing our natural heritage. I would say that just the expedition that I'm involved with to follow OR7 is kind of another way that I'm involved with trying to help get people interested in learning about what's going on in regards to wildlife in the Northwest. And if folks are interested, there's a little bit more information about that online at OR7expedition.org. So there's going to be a lot more forthcoming about that expedition here shortly, hopefully.
Great. Well, actually, you think it's a possibility that you could do a phone-in from that expedition? We could talk to you while you're actually tracking OR7?
Oh, yeah, we'd love to do that. Myself and the folks I'm going to be out with for that are really hoping to, you know, raise some attention for that. Rachel Picor, Jay Simpson, and Galileo Gans, and we are hoping to, have folks join us on the trail. If folks are interested in doing that, there's more information on the website about how they might do that. And then certainly we'll be keeping people posted with interviews and blog posts and all sorts of stuff. Like
great. So it's OR7expedition.com?
OR7expedition.org.
.org, okay. I'll try to remember that and put that on our website as well. And let's stay in touch, because when are you going to be leaving for the expedition?
That's starting in early August.
Okay, well, we'll be in touch, and maybe we can get you on live from following the tracks of OR7 sometime later on this summer.
Sounds great.
Okay, thanks a lot. Well, we've been talking with David Moskowitz, who's author of Wolves in the Land of Salmon, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, which is now working, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, my guest is Doria Robinson, who's executive director of Urban Tilth in Richmond, California, and we'll be talking about a new alliance her urban agriculture organization is forging with urban ag activists in Detroit. I'm Barbara Bernstein. My engineer is Michael McDade. We're going to go out with some music by Robbie Robertson. Thanks for listening.
Particles on the Wall.
An exploration of the effects of nuclear technology on the Pacific Northwest and the world.
Particles on the Wall.
An exhibit of art, literary works, science, and historical memorabilia that describes the human and environmental impact of the Hanford Nuclear Reservation.
Particles on the Wall.
May 3rd through June 14th, second floor gallery in the EcoTrust building.
Particles on the Wall.
Co-sponsored by Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility and KBOO Community Radio.
Particles on the Wall.
Information can be found online at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the page under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or grendelscoffee.com.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Up next is a special edition of Health Watch. Dr. David Naiman hosts an extended interview with author Michael Pollan about his new book, Cooked, an investigation of how cooking involves us in a web of social and ecological relationships.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Today's guest, Michael Pollan, is the author of six previous best-selling books, including In Defense of Food, The Omnivore's Dilemma, and The Botany of Desire. A longtime contributor to the New York Times, he is also the Knight Professor of Journalism at Berkeley, and in 2010, Time magazine named him one of the 100 most influential people in the world. Michael Pollan returns to Health Watch today to talk about his latest book entitled Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. Welcome back to Health Watch, Michael Pollan.
Thank you, David.
Well, let's start out with the enterprise of writing Cooked. What is the enterprise of Cooked?
Well, the enterprise of Cooked was kind of, you know, having recognized how important cooking is to our health and the health of our whole food system, I decided I would take a serious look at it and explore it by learning how to do it. So I divided all cooking into four essential transformations. Fire, water, air, and earth, each corresponding to a different technology for transforming food to make it more healthful and nutritious and flavorful. And in each of those areas, I apprenticed myself to a master, you know, a great baker, a great great picklers and fermenters, great pitmasters, and did my best to learn, you know, how these transformations are done and where they came from and what do they mean to us.
Is there an intentionality behind using the four elements of Greek medicine as the dividing structure for the book?
Well, you know, that was kind of I don't know exactly why it lined up so neatly, but when I started trying to come up with a typology for all cooking, I realized I could divide it into these four elements, and I think it's just a coincidence that they worked, or there is a kind of lingering value or truth to those classical elements that science has lost track of. I'm not sure exactly. It just so happened that I could line them up pretty well without a lot of shoehorning. I mean, there are kinds of cooking that don't fit into the typology that well. Sushi, for example, which is a form of cooking, even though it's a raw food. I don't know exactly where I would put it.
I love the division because it harkens back, and you always talk about how you don't rely on nutritional science, as flawed as it is, to decide how to eat, but back to tradition. And with the Greek medicine division, it's really interesting how when you pursue a master like you were talking about, we end up uncovering these people who are eccentric and obsessive around this one form of transformation of nature into culture. And they don't just seem like master cooks who are super skillful, but they also seem almost like mystics who are reverent and full of wonder around the mystery of what they're doing.
Well, I think that's exactly right. I mean, they've taken hold of something very profound in the world. I mean, how you take, say, grass seed and grind it, add water to it, and turn it into something as wonderful as bread. And that these are people who have dedicated their lives to getting really good at that particular magic. And, you know, it's not just Greek medicine, but I think Ayurvedic medicine also uses the four elements. So they have a value that we don't quite understand, but I think we do it at a kind of instinctual level.
So in Cooked, you say that cooking is literally baked into our biology. What do you mean by that?
Well, we are obligate cooks at this point. We have evolved. It was probably 2 million years ago that we seized control of fire and learned how to transform food by means of fire. When we did that, we gave ourselves an enormous evolutionary edge over some other species, because when you cook food, you get more energy from it, and you don't have to use as much energy to process it in your body. You don't need digestion. It's a very energy intense process. And cooked food is easier to digest. It's also safer and often detoxified in the case of tubers and crops like that. And you don't have to chew it as much, which saves you an awful lot of energy and time. And when we discovered cooking, it was a watershed event in our own development. This is when, according to the cooking hypothesis, which I discuss in the book, this is when the human brain undergoes its kind of quantum expansion in size and complexity, and at the same time when the human gut, or the ape gut we had, shrinks, because we don't need as much, we don't need as many metabolic resources to digest food once we've started cooking it. So, but at this point, you can't turn back. Our whole bodies and lifestyles are organized around the access to cooked food. And, yeah, people can live on raw food, and there are people who live on exclusively raw foods. But two things about them are worth noting. One is they're really dependent on the Vitamix to process their food. Otherwise, they would be spending half their waking